Joe Rogan Podcast, check it out.
The Joe Rogan Experience.
Train by day, Joe Rogan Podcast by night, all day.
This episode is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. If you're looking for something to do this summer, you might want to check out some of the upcoming fights. Even better, if you can catch them up close in person. It's quite an experience. But if you want to get the best seats, you have to act fast. And that's true for a lot of things in life, especially when it comes to hiring for your business. You need to hire the most talented people you can before the competition scoops them up. And to do that, you need ZipRecruiter. And luckily, you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/Rogan. Got your eye on a rock star candidate? ZipRecruiter's invite to apply feature lets you cut the line. Once you review ZipRecruiter's list of the most qualified candidates for your job, you can easily invite your top choices to apply to encourage them to apply sooner. So, amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/Rogan to try it for free right now. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/Rogan. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. This episode is brought to you by Mizzen and Main. No matter where you're listening, no matter what job you have, the clothes you wear to work say a lot about you. And if you're wearing boring, stiff, uncomfortable dress shirts, well, now might be the time to ditch some of the dated, boring styles in your workplace wardrobes. And that's exactly what Mizzen and Main is for. When I wear my shirt, I feel like I'm not sacrificing comfort for style. Their performance fabric dress shirts feel just as good as they look, and you could put on a Mizzen and Main and dress for the job you have. You will see it hanging in your closet and genuinely get excited to put it on. And if you're still dry cleaning your dress shirts, you're living in the past. Welcome to 2024, where Mizzen and Main has the world's most comfortable machine washable dress shirts. Mizzen and Main invented the performance fabric dress shirt 10 years ago, and they've practically perfected the thing. It's lightweight, breathable, moisture wicking, wrinkle resistant, and the most comfortable shirt on the market. Whatever you do and wherever you wear it, know that you'll look and feel amazing. Shop now at mizzenandmain.com and save 20% when you spend $130 or more using the promo code Joe Rogan.
Boom. We are live in a hotel room in the middle of Melbourne, Australia. And next door to us is some sort of a religious institution, cathedral type scenario, some fucking bunk ass bullshit old world voodoo house that's got their fucking bells ringing constantly. They get to do that. Imagine if you live next door to those assholes and it's like they decided today it was a special time to ring the gong. So we don't know what's going on. We thought it was like maybe for Paris. Because as we're doing this, Tony and I just found out maybe an hour or so ago that the Paris attacks had gone on. More than 100 people are dead. It was inside some rock and roll show.
Death metal.
Yeah, death metal show.
One more reason to never go see a death metal concert already. That's an interesting place to attack.
Yeah, it's pretty fucked up. The whole thing is pretty fucked up.
I didn't know they had death metal in Paris. It seems like it just wouldn't even exist there. Like, there'd be no base for that. Turns out there was hundreds of people there.
I think more than that. I think there's thousands. I think it's a big... I don't know. Why would you think that death metal wouldn't be popular in Paris?
Paris just seems like they're a little bit too, like, prim and proper for, death metal.
I think on paper they do. Like, if we look at it from the past,
yeah,
I don't think they're that prim and proper. I think Paris is a lot of, like, drinking and fucking and Gerard Depardieu. Like, I almost thought it stopped. It did stop.
Oh, no.
Now they're just slowly gonging. Two, three. How long are they going to do that?
I don't know. This is, like, the biggest cathedral I've ever seen, though, right? This thing's huge.
It's over. It ended. Yeah, it's pretty big, but something big. The ones in New York City, I think, are probably bigger. Mm-hmm. They're really old, though. Those old, we were saying before this started,
that those old religious houses, those old buildings, they're like, they don't make them like that anymore.
Mm-mm. I wish they did. This stuff's so cool. With Game of Thrones getting more popular, you would think like there'd be more of that type of architecture happening. People wanting to create their own kingdoms and stuff. I bet we do see more of it.
It's hard to create a kingdom today. People are too hip.
Yeah.
They're aware of what you're trying to do.
Yeah.
Like, if you tried to make a religion today where all your leaders can't have sex, like the Catholics have, yeah, they'd be like, wait, what?
Right.
Get the fuck out of here.
Nobody would want to be the leader of that. They're like, I'll follow, but I'm not going to lead.
Like, what are the laws? Like, Scientology is like the most recent of all the religions, right? Because that was started in the 50s or 60s. Like, whenever, I'm reading the middle of this book. I can't finish it. I read it and then I put it down. It's a Lawrence Wright book, mm-hmm. Going Clear, that they started that. It was the beginning of that HBO documentary. That's how it started. And I've watched the documentary and I keep getting into this book, but it's so crazy. That guy, L. Ron Hubbard, was so fucking crazy that the idea that this guy could start this global movement that has who knows how many fucking thousands of people in it and how many fucking millions, if not billions of dollars they've earned in real estate and how much they've pilfered from all these people that are inside of it. It's crazy.
It really is. I think it really preys upon the people that, like, are the weakest. I mean, how do you believe the guy was a science fiction author?
Yeah.
That should be enough. Right there. The first thing at the top of this guy's resume is that he was a big science fiction author. I mean, if George Lucas started a religion, well, I guess maybe that'd probably be a pretty cool religion.
Oh, if you would join, so many dorks would be like, I'm in! Fuck it! I'm in!
And that's really the crazy part, is I don't think L. Ron Hubbard really got that famous off of, like, his science fiction. Maybe I'm wrong, like, I don't know, but it was definitely no Star Wars. Like, you would think that. And maybe that's why he did this. Like, he's like, I haven't come up with a hit. Maybe I'll just start a religion.
Well, he is the most prolific author ever. He wrote more books than anybody that's ever lived.
Yeah, which is another thing that would be at the top of his resume that proves that he's full of bullshit. Just so much stuff. He just kept writing.
Yeah. Well, he's the most prolific bullshit artist ever. Yeah. And the other thing is that his work was, like, all first drafts. It seems like he never did a second draft ever. He just, whatever he thought, he wrote down and just slobbered through the whole thing. It's all like terrible, terrible, terrible writing. Mm-hmm. It's all like, and then the Thetans dropped the frozen volcano, the people in the volcano, and that's where your anxiety comes from. The going clear is about releasing all of it. Like, all of his ideas and principles of the ideals of Scientology, he outlined in the science fiction stories before mm-hmm. he ever put them down as, like, the actual reality of Scientology. Like, you could see, like, if you go back over his older stuff, you see him making this stuff up.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's like, on top of all that, on top of it being wild, they take so much money from these people.
10%, right? Is it a 10% thing?
And then, if you do anything bad, they, like, punish you and make you give them more money and stuff. No, it's true. Like, I was reading this article about that actress. She was in, like, Caroline Ray, I think her name is. She was in, like, some show with, like, Mike or Molly, one of those.
You talk about Leah Remini?
Yeah, that's who I'm
talking
about.
She's in the King and Queens.
Yeah.
She's in with Kevin James show.
Kevin James. That's right. I always get Kevin James and Mike from Mike and Molly confused. Big sitcom guy. But I guess, like, she went to Tom and Tom Cruise and Katie Holmes' wedding and, like, said some stuff, and everybody got mad at her, and they charged her, like, $100,000 for it. Like, something crazy like that.
Well, they didn't just charge her. They made her go through hours and hours of retraining and auditing. You know, you go through this auditing thing where you have to sit down, you go through every single last detail of everything you said and what you did during the wedding, and she had to apologize to Katie Holmes for ruining her special day, and...
Oh.
I can see Leah Remini fucking it up, though. She's, you know, she's a bold woman.
Yeah, she seems like a little party machine. She gets a few champagnes in her or something. She seems like she drinks and just starts auditing out loud, you know?
Do you think this podcast is going to get fucked up by those gongs in the background?
I think maybe it sort of gives it, like, a vibe, like, sort of a tone.
an annoying tone. Like, if you're listening to this right now, you'd be like, are they fucking really going to do this with the gongs in the background? I don't know if there's a way in this room we could get away from it. I think that's, like, the reality of where we are.
Yeah, you're on the cathedral.
That is unbelievably annoying.
Yeah.
If I lived here, I'd be so pissed. If I was trying to take my afternoon nap
and
this shit is going off, gong, 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 gong. Jesus Christ. Once upon a time, walked upon the water. Gong, 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 gong.
I think it's because of the France thing.
But there's people going in there. It looks like a wedding.
You know what I was just thinking about? Because I was reading all these tweets on Twitter about the Paris-France thing, like, as it's happening. And so many people are tweeting the same thing. They're all going, like, you know, pray for France, pray for France. And I'm just thinking to myself, like, I started thinking about prayer and what it is. And it just seems like it's something that people do to make themselves feel better.
Well, it's definitely something people do to make themselves feel better. But I mean, the idea is somehow positive thinking can correct things.
Yeah, can you imagine if there was like a if can you imagine if there was studies that showed that praying did something? What would happen?
Well, what is the placebo effect, right? The placebo effect is you believing that something is happening, even though there's no real chemical, that you're, like, you're taking a sugar pill. Mm-hmm. And just believing that that sugar pill is some miracle pill, you can somehow or another enact a physical effect on your body.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, the power of the mind, it's real. Like, there's real healing powers of the mind, and if you apply that to prayer, like, if you think that prayer really does help, if you actually believe it, it probably would have a similar effect, at least physically.
Yeah.
To placebo effect.
Yeah, on the person praying.
On the person who believes.
Yeah.
Like, if somebody prayed for you, if you had something wrong with you, mm-hmm. and someone prayed for you, it might have a physical effect on you if you actually believed they could do it. Like, if you had some Gandalf motherfucker hanging around with you.
Oh, I see. So if you believe that prayers work...
Yeah.
And somebody prays for you, and you're like, oh, man, these people are praying for me.
Yeah.
Okay.
It could have an effect.
Yeah.
I think that there's probably all these untapped ways that we can help our body, that we can, like, power up our immune system or overcome, like, certain things that are happening to our physical body just because our mind believes it.
Mm-hmm.
You know? They've shown it with the placebo effect, that it's a real effect, that there is really something going on. But we don't know how to, like, voluntarily use that without tricking ourselves, for the most part.
Yeah.
You know how this guy Wim Hof on my podcast? Fascinating fucking dude. And he's, he holds, like, 26 world records. He summited Everest in his shorts with, like, sandals on, fucking the ice cleats under the sandals.
Okay.
And he ran... half a marathon in minus 40 degree weather with shorts on and no shirt, barefoot.
Wow.
He swam 100 yards. It was supposed to be 50, but he couldn't figure out how to go. It was under the ice. He swam under the ice, and it was supposed to be 50 yards, but his retinas froze because the water was so fucking cold, so he couldn't see where he was going. So he wound up going twice as far with one breath. He wound up swimming 100 yards under the ice before they pulled him out.
Oh, my God.
Because he couldn't find the hole in the ice. He's got 26 world records, and a big part of his methodology is about breathing. And about over oxygenating, like oxygen loading on your lungs, but he's able to achieve these crazy states. Like that, he had a Dutch university or a hospital or university hospital inject him with a biotoxin, and in this biotoxin that he showed that he could activate his immune system with his own mind. Things that we thought were only autonomous sort of systems, like your immune system, like he's able to actually physically activate it with his own mind. So I think there's all sorts of different areas of the human body that are we haven't really tapped into the full potential of. And that's probably what the placebo effect shows. It shows that we just don't know how to stimulate, like the average person doesn't know how to stimulate those systems, but it is possible. We just don't know how to do it.
Yeah.
You know?
That's some interesting stuff.
Well, it's interesting because we know that certain states are bad for your immune system, like being depressed or being stressed out or being fucked up. You can get sick. Like people get sick, they get stressed, they get worn out. Like, and that if you're calm and relaxed, you can handle things better. So we know that there's certain states of mind that are more beneficial for your body.
Yeah.
We just don't know how, like most people don't know how to achieve those certain states. Grab a water over here. It's interesting. Like, we also know, like, exercise, like if you exercise, has a pretty profound effect on your body. Exercise has a profound effect on your stress levels, and that effect on your stress levels can change your health.
Yeah, it was crazy. Like, my whole clock and everything was all messed up yesterday because we just flew to Australia, and I was waking up from a nap, so I'm normally messed up after a nap anyway, but I was double messed up. And I went down to the gym, hit the steam room, and it was unbelievable how I went from, like, 24% to 100% in an hour.
Yeah.
Just from sweating and sweating and sweating and, like, just getting some of the blood flowing.
Yeah, get the blood flowing, fire up the machine, get all the systems working. Yeah. Well, that's why I always have a hard time trusting people that don't exercise.
Yeah.
Especially people that are, like, really emotional or overreact and they don't exercise. I'm like, God damn it. You don't have, like, a mitigation process. Like, mm-hmm. if you do, it doesn't evolve. You know, like, it has to be all mental. They don't have anything, like, physical.
When I was growing up,
stress reliever.
And I think it's like a Midwest thing. I feel like it's maybe it's an East Coast thing, but maybe they're better at this now, but I feel like they would just make it look like exercising. They would tell you to exercise to lose weight. There was never really, I feel like nobody was really outgoingly saying that work out to make your mind stronger.
Yeah.
And I feel like maybe it's just California, or maybe I just hang out with smarter people now. Maybe it's all of that. But, like, now it's very clear to me why working out is important. And it doesn't matter how much you weigh. But in Ohio, I felt like that was it. Like, you would never see someone with my build running, I feel like, where I'm from.
Really?
Yeah.
Skinny people don't run?
Yeah.
Why?
Nobody exercises there. It's very bizarre. People don't exercise in the middle of the country, man.
They don't?
It's creepy.
Are you sure?
It's creepy. I mean,
did you do a survey?
I'm saying not everybody doesn't exercise, but they definitely don't exercise like successful people exercise, like Californians exercise. I mean, there's obviously not everybody in California exercises, but I don't know. I feel like big food companies and soda pop companies also don't want people to know that.
Do you really think they don't want people to know that, or people are just ignorant? I think they don't even have to work hard at not having people know that. I think people are just pretty ignorant.
Yeah, I agree with that.
I think there's also, as time goes on, people are just getting more and more aware of the effect that your body has on your mind. They used to think that it was pretty separate, like especially when I was growing up. Like, I think people, oftentimes, like very intelligent people, would look down upon physical exercise because they thought that physical exercise was a vanity thing. And then you had two schools of thought, or two types of people. You had people that were brain people that were concentrating on thinking, and they were concerned with the deeper, more intellectual aspects of life. And then you had people that were like more physical people that were just trying to look good for the gym, pump their biceps up, and, you know, and go, fuck, and yeah, and look at my six-pack, yeah. But they were dummies.
Yeah.
I think now people realize that there's a connection between the mind and the body. And also, there's a discipline aspect to exercise. Nobody wants to exercise for the most part. You want the results, but it's difficult to get yourself to exert energy. And that discipline that allows you to exert energy, it's hard to, like, muster up, and it is a part of your mental makeup to be able to muster it up, to be able to discipline yourself to work out on a regular basis. Actually strengthens the mind because it exercises the discipline, And I don't think many people considered that in the past. I don't think they thought of the discipline of, you know, activating your body, like using your mind to activate your body, that you're actually exercising almost like a muscle, like discipline is like a muscle.
Mm-hmm. And I think that a lot of things correlate, you know what I mean? Like so many people are like fat and depressed.
Oh, yeah.
But, and they're depressed because they're fat, and they're fat because they're not working out, and they're depressed because they're not working out.
Yeah.
Like, one of the most natural cures for depression is like going for a walk,
yeah,
or going for a jog. Just literally just doing anything other than sitting in one spot.
Well, they've done studies that show that regular exercise is just as effective at treating depression as pills, mm-hmm, as SSRIs.
Oh yeah, I totally believe that. That's another thing that I noticed back in Ohio. It's like everybody's depressed and they're all just getting these pills and, mm-hmm, nobody's working out.
And there's place for pills. There's a place, yeah, for those pills. For some, I think some people have a legit imbalance.
Yeah.
But I think there's also, like, Ari Shaffir is a perfect example. Ari used to be on pills. Like, he was, like, legitimately depressed. Got on pills, got his life back in order, like, became a much happier person, then got off the pills. Like, he got his life in track, became much more successful, and now he's just killing it out there in the world, like, doing fantastic with his stand-up. Like, we were at a club last night, the Comics Lounge in Melbourne. There's all these Ari Shaffir posters on the wall there. He was in town just a little while ago, killing it. And he's just doing great. And now he's happy. Like, he doesn't need it. He also says mushrooms. Mushrooms helped him, too.
Mushrooms help a lot. Anytime I do mushrooms, I come back and feel good for 2 or 3 months. 2, 3, 4 months.
They should do it every 2, 3, 4 months, then.
Probably,
feel good all the time.
Probably true. For some reason, I don't. I let the thing reload and I live that stress. I feel like it almost probably sort of helps. I don't know, but maybe I'm wrong. But I feel like it's like you make the muscles tense and then massage them out rather than just get a massage. But I probably should do them once every 4 months.
When I was young, I used to think that like the whole idea of being enlightened or achieving like a more balanced, more relaxed view of the world, I used to think it would fuck up my comedy.
Mm-hmm.
That if I did that, it would ruin me. Like, I would stop being funny. Because a lot of comedy is kind of mean.
Yeah.
You know? And a lot of comedy is like, what you're creating with comedy is shitting on something. And I used to think, well, if I just achieve peace, then I won't want to shit on things. And if I won't want to shit on things, then I'll be shit out of luck.
Yeah.
As far as, like, my stand-up goes, so fuck this.
Right.
Then as I got older, I realized, well, that's just a crutch.
Yeah. It's definitely crossed my mind that, like, well, I do want to do mushrooms to feel better, but I don't want to do mushrooms because I want to be able to connect with that audience that's in the room. And if I'm too far ahead of them, I literally, you know, I think of everything that when it comes to my comedy, I'm always trying to protect it.
Yeah, if you're too kumbaya,
yeah,
you might, you know, you might lose your edge. Because your edge, too, is a lot of, like, You're a great roast writer,
mm-hmm,
and a lot of roast writing is being fucking mean.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's hard to do that if you're all kumbaya'd out.
It's true. But it helps. I mean, it's crazy. Like, my favorite stuff is always the stuff that I write when I come back a week, two, three after those trips to the desert that we take.
Yeah. Yeah, you can write some amazing shit. Like post-psychedelic experiences.
Oh, yeah. It clears the gutters, man. Makes everything flow better.
I think the writing is... I think there's all sorts of different states that you should write under. I think you should write a little when you're drinking.
Mm-hmm.
I think you should write a little sober. You should write a little when you're high off pot. You could write post-psychedelic. Writing while you're on psychedelics, though, is kind of pointless. Like, you could say things into a tape recorder, maybe, but
yeah,
sitting down trying to write things down while you're tripping.
Yeah. And even then, you forget what you felt like when you were taking the note.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's like just a code, and you can't really crack it anyway, even though the words are there. It's hard to go back to that feeling of clarity that sometimes you see. Like, I know for a fact there's been times where I'm out in that desert looking up at the stars, and all of a sudden, like, I figure out the trick to everything. You know, that feeling clicks in, right, where it's like, oh, shit, I just did it. I just beat the game. But then you just, like, can't exactly put your finger on what it was. Because to describe those feelings that happen in words, it's impossible. The words haven't been created yet to describe what goes on in that zone.
Well, describing DMT is like that, right? Like, yeah. describing a DMT experience, you're just spinning your wheels.
Yeah.
It's wasting time. I've read, like, my own descriptions of a DMT trip, and I'm like, please shut up, Don. It's like, it sounds so stupid.
Yeah.
Because the words, they don't exist. Mm-hmm. The reference points don't exist. Like, you can, there's no way you could possibly know what the fuck you're talking about. You're saying something that you're using these noises to describe, like you were describing some shit. Like we were at the airport. Oh, I should probably say we're not on a plane. And I said that we were going to do one of these on a plane. And somewhere along the line, while we're flying, I was like, fucking do it in a hotel room. Probably be better. Yeah. You know, I slept most of the time on the plane. But when we were at the airport, going through that security line, you were talking about the Popats, mm-hmm. the guys at the Popats you saw when you're doing DMT. Like, well, I kind of can kind of get that.
Yeah,
you know, like I kind of see. But if I've never done it, and I heard that, I'd be like, "What are you talking about?"
Right. Like I had no idea.
Oh, great! The fucking gongs are back.
Jesus doesn't like us talking about Popats. Yeah. You bring up Popats, the cathedral starts banging their bells. But yeah, no, I remember, I think you said something about fractals or something, or somebody did.
Yeah.
Maybe it was somebody that we were with then. I remember hearing that word, and I didn't even know what that really was at the time until afterwards. I'm like, oh yeah, fractals, like reposition, like kaleidoscope-like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's exactly what it was like. It was like a kaleidoscope of Pope.
Have you ever seen some of those 3D renditions, like computer renditions of fractals?
Mm-mm.
It's pretty fucking amazing. Like, there's an amazing fractal called the Mandelbrot set, and there's some 3D renditions where they show, you know, the closer you get to these various points on this fractal, the more the same patterns repeat themselves. Like, it looks like you're getting close to a small point, but as you get closer, it just reveals a deeper and deeper level and layer of this fractal, where it's infinite. It keeps going on and on and on and on. And as you get closer, it just shows you it's the same thing in a smaller form, and then it goes on and on and on. Mm. And that's the impression that you get when you do DMT, that there's this like infinite series of fractals that are going on all around you, and that there's no end. You can't find an end. You just look, the deeper you look, the deeper it goes. And that's sort of what they've found about the whole universe. I mean, they believe that, you know, as you look deeper and deeper into life, and you look deeper and deeper into the cellular level, deeper and deeper into the atomic level, then you get into subatomic particles, and you get into this weird world of space where it's mostly just empty air, and then there's subatomic particles that are blinking in and out of existence, and then there's things that are they have things that they've observed, what they call, that are in a superposition, which means they're both moving and still at the same time. Right. And it's like, yeah, and as you go deeper and deeper into the subatomic level, things become more and more like magic, more and more like just science fiction and craziness. Mm-hmm. Like most of what an atom is just empty space. And it's they're trying to understand it the deeper and deeper they go with this kind of stuff. But many people have theorized that what we're seeing in the universe itself, like when you look at the universe and you see like the empty space that's in the galaxies and space out in the infinite cosmos, that what you're seeing sort of mirrors itself inside our very atoms. And that,
can you imagine if they just kept digging and digging with a microscope, and they kept going through everything, and at the very end of it all, there was just L. Ron Hubbard's face.
Told you!
And it was him all along.
I am God! God works in mysterious ways! Would you imagine if we got deeper and deeper into the subatomic level and we found universes? That's what would be the ultimate trip. If we got so, like, if they figured out some way, I mean, if you look at what they could observe today as opposed to what they could observe a few hundred years ago, it's just no comparison. I mean, they have so many new, much more sensitive methods of detecting energy and detecting and recognizing structures and atoms and all this different shit. But what if it got to the point where they could detect deeper and deeper and deeper layers? And they actually really did find that inside atomic particles, that as you go deeper and deeper, you can actually find completely independent universes that operate on a scale so minute that we can't even comprehend. But if you could, and you got deeper and deeper into them, you would find like little tiny miniature black holes, little miniature galaxies, miniature planets, and the whole thing is fractal. And as you went into them, like they believe that inside every black hole, they think that every galaxy is there's a supermassive black hole at the center of that galaxy. And that supermassive black hole is 0.5% of the mass of the entire galaxy. So the larger the galaxy, the larger the black hole is. And they've theorized that if you go into that black hole, you will find another universe. So each galaxy has a black hole in it. Inside each black hole is a totally different universe filled with hundreds of billions of galaxies, each with black holes in the center of them. Each one of them has hundreds of billions of galaxies inside of it. If you go through that, there's more universes, more black holes, and that's the real fractal nature of the universe, that every time you hit a galaxy, which is just, in our mind, we can't even imagine how big a galaxy really
generations
is.
Generations from now, what it feels like is like generations, tens and tens, maybe 100 generations from now, they're going to be flying through these things in little machines. We can't fathom it now, but we're like the pirates that were coming over here on wooden ships compared to what generations, and I'm talking a lot of generations ahead of us, they're going to be flying through it. There's going to be sports, you race from one black hole to the other. Like, I mean, we are in the wrong age. We were born too early.
No, we're born perfect. This is a great time. This is a great time.
Yeah.
You don't want to be like in the future. There'll be no need for comedy. Everybody's going to be reading minds. We'll be fucked.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
They'll all be enlightened. And there'll be no hypocrisy, no contradiction. So like comedy won't exist. Like if we achieve a new state of enlightenment where humor's out the window, we would be fucked. Mm-hmm. Like we're reaping the benefits of an unenlightened public. That's like what stand-up is doing. Like we're pointing out shit that everybody should be able to see.
Right.
We're pointing out things that everybody should know. And then we're mocking things that exist that are ridiculous. Well, if people evolve past the state they are now, like if you look at like primate behavior, you look at the savagery of nature when just tooth and claw and animals just struggling to survive. And then you look at the more civilized nature of our culture today, the best aspects, when everything is working at its smoothest, usually in small groups, but in small groups and small communities, you can find some pretty peaceful existences, you know? Mm-hmm. That will ultimately be the whole world, and then it'll get more and more peaceful, more and more civilized, more and more adapted, more cultured, more connected, more enlightened, to the point where mocking things, like, it won't exist anymore. There'll be nothing to mock. People will be so advanced mentally that there will be no more of a need for comedy. So I think right now for you and I, this is a perfect time. If we were in the future and everything was all perfect and enlightened, we'd be fucked. And it wouldn't be fun, you know? Like we're in this golden stage where there's just enough retarded shit.
Right.
Like this Paris thing. There's just enough chaos in the world where it makes you appreciate all the cool aspects of the world. Mm-hmm. Like if everything was cool, I don't think we'd appreciate the cool parts as much.
You think there's a way to combat these terrorist attacks, like, you know, like, it seems like if you draw Muhammad, like, that they get really upset, right? That's, like, their big, like, oh, no, don't do that thing. Like, so, like, I don't know, I'm just pitching here. Like, what if every time they did something like this as a defense mechanism, like, CNN just put out, like, the Muhammad cartoon. Like, if they called in South Park's guys and were like, guys, let's do this. Let's bring in our nuclear warfare, and you make a hilarious Muhammad thing of him just getting whatever, you know, butt raped or whatever. Like, I don't know. Like something crazy.
Do you really think that would fix it? Mocking it?
As a defensive mechanism, if they kill people. That's the only way. Listen, terrorists, it's me, Prime Minister Tony Hinchcliffe. From now on, if you do an attack, if somebody said this, if you do an attack and you kill innocent people, every innocent person that you kill, that's going to be another 2 minutes, or another 5 minutes, of the Muhammad cartoon.
That might be one of the dumbest ideas I've ever heard.
They hate the Muhammad thing. So
yeah, but don't you think there's a big difference between killing people and drawing cartoons? Like, what is worse?
These terrorists don't seem to think so, though, right?
But they're not killing all these people in Paris because of a cartoon. They killed a few people that were doing those Charlie Hebdo cartoons.
Yeah.
I think the real problem is when people get their mind in a pattern, you get your mind in some sort of a radical ideology like Islam or radical Islam, it's super difficult to get people out of that radical ideology. It's very, very difficult. Very difficult to get them to rethink, to change these patterns in their mind where they go, yeah, actually, it doesn't make any sense to just go to some random death metal concert and gun people down. Mm-hmm. Like, and yell, God is great. Yeah, it doesn't make sense. That's crazy. That's chaos.
Right.
That is an evil thing to do. And that doing this evil thing for religion, like saying you're doing it for religion, doesn't make any sense at all. But in their mind, it's justified. In their mind, there's a holy war going on. These people that are completely radicalized, like, in their mind, this is a good thing to do. In their mind, this is, like, what you have to do to get back at the infidels and attack this evil empire that's invading countries or supporting this or, you know, whatever crazy war is going on in the world as far as the ideologies, as far as, like, invading certain holy lands. And what ISIS is doing, they're blowing up old monuments, and there's so much crazy shit that's going on in the world that's related to radical ideologies. You'd have to figure out how to rewire their brains.
Can I tell you what another thing I think we should do? I think we should take guys on death row and put bombs on them and have them go into the places with the terrorists.
You might be the worst foreign policy advisor ever. I want to sit you down with all these five-star generals that are in these fucking smoky rooms plotting the future. What do you want to do? Well, I want to take Jared from Subway.
Strap bombs to him and send him over to... Well, why would he do that? I didn't think of that. Well, why would Jared keep walking? Why would he detonate? Is he going to know he's going to blow up? He's not going to tell them?
All right, maybe we put him in. We take these guys and we put them in... on cars that are like on remote controls or
Google cars,
drones. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. There you go.
Yeah.
They just killed that Jihadi John guy. They killed that guy with a drone. He's that guy that was a rapper. He was a rapper in England. And he joined ISIS and he's been killing people and beheading them. Allegedly, you know, there's the black helicopter squad that believe that this is all bullshit, but
there was a rapper in ISIS.
Yeah.
Vanilla ISIS.
Oh,
jeez.
Son of a bitch.
Oh, that's the thing that I'll end up getting death threats for out of this.
You can't help yourself with that, can you?
No.
With puns?
No, when I hear a funny word and it's a right setup and I think there's just one chance for it. The funny thing is I never do them on, like, I'm known for them, but I never do them on stage with my stand-up. Like, I would never do that. But I love making them in person. I just love comedy, you know what I mean? I'm terrible at impressions. But, God, they crack me up. Like, there's nothing that I don't love about comedy. And a lot of comedians are like, oh, fuck, a pun. You know, I hate puns. But it's like...
You like puns even though you don't use them on stage. Like,
right.
You like it. It's like,
and I think,
you just love the form.
I think everybody does. I think there's a war on puns right now.
A war on puns.
Because everybody wants to complain about puns, but it's like... Everybody laughs so hard. Like, a good pun hits harder than almost anything.
I laugh at puns. I laugh at your puns because they're so ridiculous.
Yeah.
But it's almost like a reluctant laugh, like, oh, you son of a bitch.
Yeah, but sometimes they're like, you know, Jedi puns, you know what I mean? That are just like, how the fuck did you think of that quick?
Well, you, like, take pride in grabbing them as quickly as they can. Like, mm-hmm. the puns come out of the event.
Yeah.
And you just grasp them as quick as you can.
Right.
My brain does not think in puns at all.
It's definitely a different muscle. Like, it's hard for me to think of a pun and be intellectual at the same time. Like, it's definitely, like, it's like that thing where, like, rubbing your head and your stomach at the same time but going different directions, you know?
People can't do it.
Because I've noticed that, because you have to, like, listen to do that thing, and you sort of have to be ADD at the same time to do a pun. Since this isn't a video podcast, I'll tell you, Joe's trying to do the hand on the head.
I'm rubbing my head in two different directions and my stomach in two different directions. I go back and forth and back and forth. Yeah. Yeah, it's a different muscle. The pun muscle is definitely a different muscle.
Yeah.
But it's also like a different comedic instinct. Like, we were talking about guys who get trapped in certain patterns of comedy. Mm-hmm. Like, you get trapped in an act. Like, all you do is, like, this style of comedy. And then when you have that sort of trap, you can get – it kind of fuck you up. We were talking about guys who, like, only do, like, evil – type comedy, or they only do this type comedy. They only have, like, they have an act they do, or it's a persona they adopt.
Right.
Like a Larry the Cable Guy or an Emo Phillips or something like that.
Or like a one-liner guy.
Yeah.
That goes slow. And like,
yeah. And that you get stuck. And those are like, when it's done right, it's awesome.
Yeah.
Like a Steven Wright or something like that. Or you know the best one ever, I think, was Mitch.
Yeah.
Hedberg was the best.
Yeah.
Because he was so prolific.
Yeah.
Like, his mind worked in that way. Like, his style of comedy worked in these non sequitur one-liners where he could just, one after another, have these, like, totally unrelated things.
Unbelievable. You know, I was thinking of him. I just told you about that Amy Winehouse documentary that blew my mind to shreds.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking about him during it because...
Heroin,
and the art that Amy Wine, she was always like very genuine, like a real artist, and always wrote only her own stuff, and like you can tell like through her work, like it was really actually amazing, and they show you through this documentary. And then something happens. She was always a heavy drinker, always quite the partier, like a rock star, you know what I mean? But then when she started doing heroin, because this guy that she was with was into heroin, the lyrics and the songs were a whole nother level. I mean, we've seen it a bunch of times, but I mean, it really went to another level. And it made me think of Mitch Hedberg, because there's something with that drug, or I mean, I'm not taking anything away from Mitch, because he's the one that did it, but it just can't be coincidence that these people on heroin are able to tap into some super, super mechanism.
Yeah.
Because who would have guessed that anybody would come out better than Steven Wright at that thing? Like, you watch Steven Wright, and 10 minutes in, I'm like, how is he going to fill an hour with this? Right. This seems impossible. And then I agree with you completely that Mitch came in over the top. And how's that possible? How could Mitch Hedberg not just see Steven Wright and go, well, I got to figure out something different to do, because there's no way I'm going to be able to do that better than that guy.
Right.
I mean, Steven Wright was the man. But my goodness, if he didn't do it. And there's something about those jokes. If you just look at them just written out, like sometimes I'll see like a meme with mm-hmm. Mitch Hedberg on it, and I'll end up staring at that. And I'm not a meme guy at all, but I'll end up staring at that little tiny thing, which were all the original tweets, by the way. Mitch Hedberg was the original Twitter guy.
Yeah,
I mean, and
like, think of that banana joke that I love so much.
Which one's
like,
that?
it goes, somebody asked me if I want a frozen banana. I said no, but I want a regular banana later. So yes. It's like a perfect. It's a perfect Twitter joke, and it's so ridiculous.
Yeah,
it's also a joke that if you looked at it on paper, maybe it wouldn't be a good Twitter joke unless you knew Mitch Hedberg's voice. Maybe then it would be a good Twitter joke because you knew how he does jokes.
I still think it'd be great on Twitter, but that is another thing. You have a great point there. It's like when you factor in his timing and beats, which also I think plays into the heroin thing. Mm-hmm. You look at all the rock stars and all that, and most of them seeming more like, I feel like it's more of like an acoustic type of drug, if that makes sense, mm-hmm. to where like more like Nirvana and Winehouse, who was very jazzy, you know, those types of tones. And I just feel like there's a direct crossover. I feel like Hedberg really was like, God, was he dialed in? Because that voice and that timing, really timing and pacing is the trick. He could have had any accent and any voice. But, you know, when you decide to start that next line after a period, like in between spaces, is so important in comedy. I think, like, people really don't know that. I think they think that you could say a joke at any way, but it's really, like, you know, there's just guys, like, look at Joey Diaz and Sebastian Maniscalco. I mean, everybody, really. It's all down to timing, but sometimes you can really see it with someone.
Well, I think what you're saying is that they find their voice, they find their rhythm, and then their comedy, like, even though, like, maybe you and I would look at it on paper, the premise on paper, and go, how is that fucking funny? But, like, Sebastian has such a way with being Sebastian that he makes things that it's hard to figure out, like, what is the unfathomable, what is the ungraspable quality of what he's talking about that's uniquely funny in his voice?
Right.
You find that, whatever it is.
Yeah.
That's through practice,
like,
too.
I mean, like, if you, talking about, since we're talking about the on-paper thing, like, you said the Hedberg thing, and, like, that's pretty funny on paper, but now if you really, like, broke down, like, if you were reading a Joey Diaz, like, on paper, what's up, you cocksuckers? Yeah. Like, it's like, it makes...
You gotta eat the yolk. You gotta eat the... You can't eat the whites.
Eat the yolk. You cannot eat the whites. Like, it's like, it wouldn't make... It wouldn't be funny at all on paper, but you give him the... You gotta... You... I'm not fucking... Over, you know what I mean? It's just so passionate, and it's all timing there. I mean, and so when there is a something on paper, when he does hit one of those written things, it's just boom.
Isn't that also a weird thing about comedy? It's like, you got to figure out what is funny in your mind.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how is it funny through your voice? And the only way you figure that out is by doing comedy over and over and over and over and over and over and over again.
Yeah.
Like, you got to get to this point where it kind of makes sense to you. You figure out how to do it. That's so hard to figure. Like, you could never look at a guy like Mitch Hedberg before he ever did stand-up and go, I know what you should do. Like, you can't.
Right.
You'll never get it. You'll never get it. Like, that, it is not like anything else.
Yeah.
Like, it has to be this unique combination of his personality, his insight, his timing, his experience on stage, and his willingness to sit down and write shit out as much as possible.
Mm-hmm.
Like, his act is all writing. It's all writing.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, like, a guy like Sebastian, it's all performing.
Yeah.
It's all things. They're, you know, both very funny.
Yeah.
But it's figuring out what it is about the way you're sitting around looking at the world. How is it funny coming out of your head?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. The more and more that I do this, the more and more that I do stand-up, and it's been, in May, it'll be 9 years. The more and more that I do it, the more and more that my newest material, my most recent stuff, is always the best stuff. And I'm not writing as much as I was years ago, because I'm just writing more good stuff, if that makes sense. I'm writing less extra stuff, and, like, I guess I'm writing the same amount of stuff, but I'm having more good stuff because I'm writing more in that voice. I'm starting to figure out what that is.
Yeah.
Like, even down to, like, the physicalities, for example, that I do, because I barely move on stage. I'm pretty stabilized and sort of...
Pretty stationary, right?
Huh? Yeah, very stationary. Sometimes I'll tuck my arm behind my back. Maybe I'll switch my shoulder levels to the left, to the right, to the middle. I'll move that around a little bit. But I'm very unordinarily stationary, I feel like. And however, you know, one of the things that I do is sometimes I'll rattle off things and I'll count on my fingers and I'll point some way. Just nothing too crazy, but little things. And those are always, you know, when I use that divisively, it has to work. So I have their brain sort of trained now. And it's just something that happened naturally. Because I don't really talk with my hands a lot and stuff. So, but when I do talk with my hands, I want it to be like thunder. You know what I mean?
Have you ever noticed that Joey never takes the mic out of the stand?
It's amazing.
He puts the mic in the stand. He leaves it in the stand. And I think part of that is he wants both of his hands free.
Because
he talks with his hands so much.
Yeah.
He doesn't want to be trapped holding that microphone.
Yeah.
And it is physical stuff, like, he involves the mic stand.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he'll hang on to the mic stand during his physical stuff.
Yeah. I love it. And when he lifts it up and slams mm-hmm. it down real quick, it's just like, you know he's killing if that's happening.
He's kind of always done that, too. He's always, for the longest time at least, not taking the mic out of the stand.
Yeah. I always have respected that tremendously. I always take the mic out of the stand, but I love the fact that, you know, that it's possible to just have that kind of...
Did Rodney take the mic out of the stand?
I don't think so. No, I can't picture him holding a microphone.
Huh. I kind of like see like a similarity there. Yeah. How, you know, using the hands, Joey did.
Mm-hmm.
But everybody else does. Like, you do. You take it out of the stand. I do. Ari does. Duncan does. We all have our own way.
Yeah.
Like, if I had to do a whole set with the mic in the stand, I'd feel so weird.
Yeah. I always think it's weird. Like, I didn't notice this until recently, but, like, a lot of those late-night sets, they don't have a microphone or a mic stand.
Yeah.
Have you ever done any of those?
No.
Had to go no hands?
I don't think so. Maybe I have.
You keep the mic in the mic stand. Or no. You take them.
I take it out, but I'm trying to think. Yeah. Have I ever done that? Have I ever done a late night show where I didn't use a mic? I don't know. Yeah. That's a good... If I did, it was so long ago.
Mm-hmm.
But...
I don't know what I'd do. I mean, what am I going to do? Stand there with my hands on my hips and like just like arms crossed? You can't do that. Like, oh, hello, everybody.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, also, you can't modulate your voice in the microphone the way you can when you're holding a microphone, or if it's in a stand. Like, you can, like, you talk closer to it to get louder. You pull away to get softer. You can modulate. You can change it and adjust it on the fly.
Yeah.
Did you ever see Chris Titus used to, I don't know if he still does it, but he has one of them Bobby Brown setups where he's like a teleconferencer.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little microphone that comes, he's got like a headset, and the microphone comes down to the corner of his mouth and he talks like that.
That shit creeps me out.
That's a weird choice.
Yeah.
It's a weird choice for a comedy club.
I mean, why would you want to have the same headset as like a TED Talks or like you know, it's just too like telecommunic.
Well, his thing is different. Like, his style of comedy is different. His style of comedy is more like a performance piece. You know, everything is like tight. Like, he told me, I asked him like how he writes, and he writes all of it out before he ever does it. He has like a theme. Like, this is his theme, and he writes his whole set. He writes this theme out, and then he performs it almost like a one-man show, more than like a stand-up comedy show. And maybe having one of those headsets makes people feel like they're at a different sort of thing. Like, oh, he doesn't even have a microphone in his hand like a regular comedian. He's got this whole thing where he's got a little headset on with a loop that comes down by his face, and I see that little loop, and oh, and it might maybe kind of puts you in a different mindset as a person watching it. I'm watching a theatrical presentation as much as I'm watching stand-up.
Yeah. I know that when I see that headset to grab the remote and change the channel. That's what the headset tells me psychologically.
What do you think? Do you think pretentious? Like, what goes into your head? Yeah.
Oh, yeah, totally. I think we're like, who's trying to, like, reinvent, you know, you... I think there's something so cool about taking the mic out of the mic stand the same way Eddie Murphy did in Raw and Richard Pryor Live on the Sunset Strip and all that stuff. That's a magic. That's what's amazing. That mic and that mic stand is all we need. That stool, that is it. Yeah. That is it. Maybe there's a bottle of water out there. Maybe there's a towel. Maybe there's... It's about it. And that's it. And that's what I love about it. You take that away, then you have the same stage that's there in the middle of the day when no crowds there's no magic. I always love that feel, that vibe. I even like sound checks. Sound checks give me the chills when there's nobody out there and you just see the mic and the mic stand that's going to be used that night, like that instrument of death just standing there. But an empty stage is sort of just sad to me. Then he just has the stool or something, like, I don't even know. It's just I'm not into that. He seems like the kind of guy that would have, like, wacky backgrounds, too, in his specials.
Like, maybe his name in giant block letters.
Right, like, and, like, memories from his childhood are back there and stuff. Like, kid pictures.
Oh, no. And then he moves over towards that section when he's talking about certain things.
Yeah.
Well, when you have that headset on, I expect you to be giving some sort of a motivational Anthony Robbins type speech.
Right.
How do I invigorate my staff? Mm-hmm. How do I get my employees as enthusiastic as I am? Mm-hmm. Well, that's a good question. And he's pacing back and forth.
Yeah. I don't know anything about Christopher Titus. That's what's crazy. It's like I've made friends with so many comedians and worked with so many people and met and this and that. I don't know anything about him. And I attribute a lot of that to the headset style that he has. I think we come from two totally different sides of the spectrum. I'm just guessing. Like, I don't even know what he talks about or anything about him, but I'm guessing him and I are like two different schools.
I don't know. You'd probably have to go see him. I haven't seen him live in a long fucking time.
I feel like Gallagher used one of those, right?
I think so. Yeah. Yeah, he had to. He's smashing shit with a watermelon. With a hammer, rather.
Mm-hmm.
If you're using that giant sledgehammer, you have two hands and a sledgehammer, you have to have a headset.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
I wonder if he had wires. Because when he was doing it, man.
Yeah.
Dean Del Rey was telling me about the guy who invented the wireless headset. Or the guy who invented the wireless microphone. He had him on his podcast. And Dean knows the guy, and apparently it took the guy like a decade or more to figure out how to do it right.
The things still almost never work. I think he should still get back to the drawing board on it, because that shit always gives out. I hate wireless mics. They're just not as much fun as ones with cords.
They work pretty flawless. Yeah. I had to do one today. I used one today at the weigh-ins. That was a wireless mic.
Well, yeah, but that's a big, big top. You're at the top level of production there. Like plus that mic, they have enough battery in that thing, and the thing you did wasn't that long, you know what I mean?
Right,
have that all juiced up with a double backup and a pipe. They have one shot at it.
Everything they changed else, the battery. When we're doing a 6-hour show, mm-hmm. they changed my battery for my battery pack, because mm-hmm. I have a wireless battery pack. I have a wireless mic that is in my ear. So when I am going onto the into the octagon, I have a backup, like a battery that's in the microphone, and then I also have batteries that are in the receiver where there's an earpiece. So the production can talk into my ear, like they'll say things like, we have a replay for you. If you want to go to that, let us know, or we'll follow your lead. They'll say things like that. Like maybe I'm talking to someone about something like particularly interesting that happened during the fight, and they'll tell me like we're about to show it. Or like a lot of times when fighters are rambling about their sponsors and thanking Allah or fucking Moses or whatever, they'll like say to cut them off, which I can only do so much. I kind of but. Those batteries, they changed those batteries at least once during the course of the UFC. Like, they put a fresh one in the beginning and then change it halfway through.
Yeah. There's just simply never as many problems with wires as there are with wireless stuff.
Yeah. Except the Comedy Store, the microphone the other day was fucking, the wire was falling out at the bottom.
The Comedy Store, once every few months that happens, because so many comedians are dropping the mic and trying to use it as a prop. And
yeah.
It's craziness there. People are so desperate.
Well, it's also that mic gets used by all the open micers doing potluck, too.
Yeah.
So it gets used by, 20 people that have maybe never even held a mic before every Monday.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
What were you saying, though, about the guy that invented the wireless mic?
Oh, Dean Del Rey had him on his podcast, and Dean was explaining to me how long this guy worked to develop that and how fucking rich this guy is now. This guy owns like the most expensive house in San Francisco. Hmm. He has some crazy castle that he built just from the money that he made from the wireless mic.
Wow.
And yeah, I will let Dean explain it. I wish I could remember. If you just Google Dean Del Rey's Let There Be Rock or Let There Be Talk, that's his podcast, right?
Mm-hmm.
He's got an episode somewhere in there where he talks to the guy who invented the wireless mic, and the guy explains it. Hmm. But what a freak out that is. The guy figured out how to make a frequency that you can tune into in a building. I think he said the Rolling Stones were the first ones to use it. But then once they started using it, everybody wanted to use it. Like, wait, what? Like, the guitar is not connected to wires? What the fuck?
Yeah.
You know, and then they have to have a different frequency, obviously, for the guitar than they do for the other shit that's going on.
Wow.
A few different frequencies that are
floating around in the air like radio signals.
I like the wires, man. I think it gives us a feeling of stability and connection. And, like, I don't know, there's something about losing the particles of art in the air that just seems risky to me. It really does. Like, I mean, there's just so few problems with the wired mic. You know, there's that on-off switch, and there's a button there, and sometimes when you're performing, you feel it against your thumb. You're like, whoa, that's close, and you gotta, like, turn it. That's, like, one more problem that we need up there.
Yeah.
That is just, like, a little, and, you know. And sometimes it is off, by the way, because I go out there first sometimes, and every once in a while, there's nothing crazier than you on this side mic going, Melbourne, what the fuck is up? And the place just goes, yeah! And you bring me up the Golden Pony, Tony Hinchcliffe, and I walk up, and then it's like a 15, 20-second walk to the mic sometimes in these big venues, and you grab the mic, and you're like, what's up, Melbourne? And you realize that the power's not on, and then you have to hit the button. Dude, it happens like 5 or 10% of the time. I don't make a deal about it or complain about it, but when there's a wireless mic, 5 to 10% of the time, that's the ratio I'm giving for this, there's a problem. Normally, they're not turned on in the beginning. Like, it's like the easiest thing that everybody forgets to do. And then I'm stuck. I know how to turn all those on, by the way, from that. I never owned one of these mics or took a class. You end up finding out where every button is on every mic. Yeah, and it, with 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 people watching, and they don't even realize. They're like, oh, he's taking his time saying hello to us. It's like, no, I already tried.
Well, there used to be the old ones had the antennas in the bottom, and if you got too close to the antenna, it would cut off. Mm-hmm. Like, if you'd hold it too close to the bottom, they'd tell me, even in the early days of the UFC, when I would do post-fight interviews, don't grab the bottom of the mic. You had to grab, like, or towards the top. And I would grab it, like, with my index finger and my my thumb, and sort of let my other fingers relax, so I didn't want to grip it too tight at the bottom, because I worried that it would cut off the signal somehow. Mm-hmm. Like, if you grab it low, like a fighter sometimes, they would take the mic from me, or they would hold on to the mic as well, and they would touch the bottom of it, and it would cut off the signal. Yeah, they're more problematic. There's something, you could use cords too, you know, use them as props, as part of, like, the cord.
Yeah.
That you could, like, I had a bit that I used to do about having a girl jerk you off. It's like trying to brush your teeth with your left hand. Like, they don't have the type of coordination that's developed over years and years of jerking off.
Right.
You know, like when a girl says, I'll just do it with my hand. Like, what would make you think that you could possibly be as good at that as me?
Right.
And I would do this bit where I would hold the cord with my left hand, and I'd be jerking it off like a girl with a tired arm. Like, oh my God, I have to switch hands. Yeah. And, like, I needed the cord. If I didn't have the cord, it wouldn't work as well.
Yeah.
If I needed a physical thing in my hand that I was tugging on, it made more sense. Then I was just, if I was doing it in the air, the bit would be like 10% less effective.
Mm-hmm. And plus, I feel like there's just something fun, especially when we're doing like big theaters and big stages. There's something fun about that whip, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, just like getting it out of the way. Because I think it sort of tells the audience, like, I'm going to get this out of the way because I have stuff to do. I have stuff to share with you.
Mm.
You know what I mean? Like, get this shit and like moving it. I feel like that's all sort of like training the audience to sort of be like, oh, he knows what he's doing, you know what I mean? Like, he's getting that out of the way. Something's about to happen. Like, I don't know. I feel like there's something. I'm just pro-cord all the way.
How many clubs have you performed at in New York City?
Pretty much all of them.
Have you ever noticed that, like, a lot of the clubs in New York in particular, they have really small stages, really small. The craziest was Caroline's. Caroline's would have two different stages. They'd have the regular stage, and then they'd have the sellout stage, where they would take the wings off the side. And you would be in a sold-out room of 300 people, and they would be fucking on top of you. I mean, literally, they could touch your dick. Mm-hmm. They could reach out and just touch you. You're so close to the audience. Their tables are so small, and everybody's stuffed in there. And I think that that style of comedy, like, there's a certain type of intimacy in those clubs, like Stand Up New York is like that. There's a certain type of intimacy in those clubs because you can't move around very much.
Yeah.
You can't get very physical, and you almost have to talk to the audience. You almost have to address them,
right?
Because they're right in front of you.
Yeah, it's so small. Like, I don't think people realize when they're watching, like, Louis, how small that stage is at the Cellar.
Oh, it's tiny.
there's nothing there. It's like a shoebox.
Yeah.
It's like really, really, really crazy small.
Whereas, like, even the belly room's bigger than that.
Oh, yeah. Oh, definitely.
Yeah. The OR's bigger than that.
Oh, yeah.
I think the OR's the perfect room.
Mm-hmm.
I think the original room at the Comedy Store is literally the perfect room. I think the belly room almost might be too small, but it's a good proving ground. It's a good place to fuck around.
It's a good room to get good for the OR.
Yeah. And then the main room is, like, the big show.
Yeah. Da-da-da-da. Yeah. But the main room still... I would take a sold-out hot OR crowd over a sold-out main room crowd.
Yeah.
Because it's OR, while it's harder, it's more fun to kill in. I'm telling you, I had this set the other night, and it's because of Joey Diaz. Because Joey Diaz made them believe that miracles could happen. That's what happened. Joey Diaz made this audience think that they were at the greatest thing ever. And I was there, too. I was in the back of the room watching him, my hands hurting from clapping. And it fucking pumped me up, man. And I had more fun in the OR the other day at the Comedy Store. It's just, you know, I feel like it's not supposed to be that way. I should have had more fun in Atlanta headlining my own shows or, like, you know, at Oddball or whatever. But it's like there's something about that OR. It's probably because it's the first place I ever went up.
Well, I forgot what it was like when I was not there for 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
I forgot. I didn't, and I kind of knew there's something cool about it. But going back, like when I went, it's been a year now since I've been back, because I went back last November.
Mm-hmm.
And when I went back, I was like, whoa, this place is crazy. I forgot. There's like a unique feeling in that room.
Mm-hmm.
Because that was Ciro's nightclub, and because of how many people died there, and how much crazy shit has gone on in that room. Think about how much performing has been in that building.
Oh, yeah. There's nothing like it anywhere, because it's been every day of the year from 9 till 2 in the morning, every day of the year.
Yeah.
Every day of the year. Like, unless there's some crazy thing that's going on. They only closed for one day after that shooting.
Yeah.
And even... Oh, I guess they stopped that show when it happened. Yeah.
Yeah.
But,
I mean, Christmas, New Year's, Hanukkah. Yeah.
Those are big days.
Rosh Hashanah.
Big days for them.
Every day. Mm-hmm. Every day. 7 days a week.
Yeah.
365 days a year. And it's the, like Mitzi used to call it, the home for misfit toys. The island of misfit toys, that's what she used to call it.
I think about that a lot. You know, we were just talking about the hauntings last night at the Comedy Store. And yeah, I think that it could have to do with all the people that have gotten killed there. But I think there's also something to be said about that being a building in which every night there's this burst of energy for 5 or 6 hours, and then back down to complete silence, to where you can hear a roach on the other side of the building walking across the main room stage. You know what I mean? Like, it gets so quiet there. And then, what, 16 hours later, blah, 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 every room filled to the gullets with human beings for 5 or 6 hours, and then boom. Like, that doesn't happen anywhere. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah. That fucking gong again.
Yeah.
Ding dong, ding 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 dong. It's a shitty non-melodic tune, too. You hear that?
Yeah, they used to really, like, fucking, music used to suck. All they had were these 6 church bells.
You know what's amazing is that they figured out how to write music down, and you could recreate it. Like, da-da-da-da. Like, they figured out how to write that down.
Yeah.
And you look at sheet music, which I can't read, but people who can read it, they look at that, and they can perform something that was written down way before things were ever recorded. Like, music was ever... Like, they didn't figure out how to record music until, like, what? What was it, like, the 1800s or the 1900s? Whenever they figured out the first phonographic record.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably, like, the early 1900s or the late 1800s. Whatever the fuck it was. Whenever they figured out how to record an album, you know, on wax. Yeah. Think about how long they wrote stuff down that you could recreate. But, like, you couldn't recreate, like, songs, like, as far as, like, how someone could sing. Like, if you think about the difference between the way Amy Winehouse sings and the way, you know, fill in the blank, you know?
Yeah.
Any other, you know, Barbara Streisand sings or
Aretha
Franklin sings, you know? You looked at Aretha Franklin, like, how could you ever recreate that on paper where you could understand?
Right. You better say thanks. Think about what you're trying to do to me. Yeah.
You never could ever, you know, you never nail James Brown.
Ow! Da, 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 da. Yeah. Get up. Get on up.
You could never figure out how to relay that to people mm-hmm. without them actually hearing it.
Makes you wonder what we missed.
Oh, yeah. Singing and all that stuff. Well, you know, that's one of the things I'm listening to, this Dan Carlin Hardcore History Podcast. And it's part of it is about Herodotus and how Herodotus, the way he would write history, was so theatrical and so there was so much flavor to the way he wrote things that they think that part of it was what he wrote was meant to be performed. That it was not just a written thing that was meant to be read, but it was meant to be performed in like these theatrical presentations. And that's how they used to relay history, which is why it had so much flavor to it. It was designed to rope people in that were watching it. They were probably fucked up on homemade wine and, you know.
Yeah.
And those amphitheaters, those places that they had developed, where they would have like a flat surface on the ground and these like tiered stairs all around them. And they would have to project their words. Like, all that style of acting was all based on having to project so that people could hear you. Mm-hmm. That sort of flavored how early acting was. A lot of early acting was very over the top.
Yeah.
And a big part of that was because they had to hear you in the back of the room. They didn't have microphones.
Yeah. And now a lot of the best stuff is the opposite. Like, I feel like a lot of my favorite actors are, like, very, very, very chill. Mm-hmm. Very, very mellow.
Oh, yeah. Well, you think about what you can get done mm-hmm. with, like, a quiet voice now that you could never do before.
Yeah.
You know? With the smoldering mm-hmm. that you could do now that you
and
could
never HD, do before. And the HD, like, you can really see their face and the way that they... If they're upset or they're sad or anything. And now acting, I feel like, has been, you know, so amplified.
Yeah, it's really interesting what they've been able to do as far as broadcasting and recording people's movements and people's talking. And well, even in like martial arts, like we're going to go see the UFC tomorrow. But I'll tell you, man, when I was young, like watching people much better than me fight and watching them kick and watching them like perform techniques made me understand how to do them correctly because I could watch them. But you had to be around these guys to watch them. Like when I was a kid, I used to study tapes. At the time, it was like VHS tapes. But it was like one of the first times that people had VHS tapes to study. Mm-hmm. It was in the 80s. Because before that, you had to have like a projector. You had to get like a projection. And like Mike Tyson used to watch old films at Customato's house. He would go down, he would operate one of those reel-to-reel projectors and watch old films of people fighting. And he learned from their movements, like how to mimic and how to imitate those movements and how to learn from those movements. And now, you could just go to YouTube. You could find something. Like, fighters today in the UFC, they have such a massive advantage of, like, being able to mirror and imitate and sort of recreate the movements of like great fighters because mm-hmm. you could see how they do it. You could watch every Anderson Silva fight that he ever had in the UFC. Anybody could watch him.
Yeah.
And you could see what he was able to do and how he moved.
It almost seems like we're at the point almost where like, I don't know, decades from now, fighters will be able to like spar 3D with their opponent coming up that they're actually going against in the octagon.
Oh yeah, definitely.
You know,
yeah,
that they're gonna get their real effects and real moves, like mm-hmm. what they do, the kicks, the angles that you could just practice with that stuff. You can't.
Yeah, you'll have holograms.
Yeah,
you'll have holograms. Maybe you could wear a suit, and when that person hits you mm-hmm. in the hologram, like you'll feel some sort of an impact. Like, not to the point where it'll hurt, but right. you'll be aware of when they connected on you.
Yeah.
And maybe when they connect on you, like, their holographic image will respond as if they actually hit you. Like, they won't kick through you. They'll kick up into the point where it touches you, and you'll feel it on your chest. Like, you'll have some sort of a suit on. That's totally within the realm of possibility for the future when technology advances.
Yeah.
Virtual reality, too, man.
virtual reality is going to be so fascinating. What they're going to be able to do with movies, you're going to be able to watch 3D movies where you put a virtual reality headset on and you're going to be immersed in the movie. You'll be able to go through like a crime scene and look down at the body and look down at the person who's trying to cover up the evidence and look out the window and see the cops pull up and holy shit. And you're going to like be a part in the actual movie itself.
Yeah.
All these different ways to experience it. Instead of being able to experience a movie in a flat, sort of a two-dimensional way where you're forced to watch the scene as the director had laid it out, you're going to be able to change and alter the scene yourself by your own perspective. You could decide to stand on a chair in the scene, you know, and look at it from up above, or get down on your knees and like look down at the body, look down at the murder weapon, or look down at the grass these people are playing in. You're going to be able to manipulate your perspective, and it'll change how you enjoy a film.
Yeah. Makes me want to start writing one like that.
Yeah, man.
I like that thing you just started. Like, it's like, you know, it almost, yeah.
Jeez. Well, like a three-dimensional game. Like, if you play a game like Quake or Unreal or, you know, some 3D shooter where you're going down these hallways, you can pause at any time and look at the ground, look at the walls, and it becomes like an interactive thing. Mm-hmm. And instead of, and it's still obviously a work of art, it's still, when you're playing a game, like if it's not an interactive game, or if it's not rather a multiplayer game where you're playing against another person, if it's just you versus the computer, you're still choosing how to approach it and how to interface with the game. You could pause if you like, you could stop and not move forward, or you could run, or you could go left, or you could go right. You could choose, and you're choosing to how you interact with this piece of art. Like, a video game is really a piece of art. You're kind of choosing how you connect to it. You know, I think that's very likely going to be the way we experience movies. Like, you're going to be able to choose how you interact with it. But then the problem with that is, then it won't be, like, a film won't be something that you really necessarily would enjoy watching it with other people.
Right.
Like, at a movie theater.
Yeah.
It's going to be so different if you have a virtual reality headset on.
It's true, but I think watching movies with people's way overrated.
Do you?
When's the last time you went to a movie theater by yourself? I bet it's been a while, right?
Long time.
I never even thought about it. Again, maybe it's just a Midwest thing where it's like, you don't go to a movie by yourself. Like, I feel like that's
a freak.
Like, crazy. Yeah, exactly. What are you, a school shooter? You don't go to a movie by yourself. But man, when there's, and you know, I love my girlfriend. She's amazing. And she loves movies. And we go and we see movies. But there's something about going by yourself. And you just have both armrests, and there's just no distractions.
No one's touching you and asking you questions.
When's the last time somebody whispered something in your ear at the movie theater and you said, thank you for that information? Like, I'm really grateful for that information. I wouldn't have known that or noticed that had you not, you know. A movie is supposed to, like, you're supposed to have your own take on it. You know what I mean? Like, Quentin Tarantino said with Pulp Fiction that he wanted everybody that saw that movie to have seen a different movie, to think that something else happened and miss a part, and like have everybody almost have like a different DNA for that movie. Like, that he didn't want two people to see the same thing. And it makes sense completely that for that movie. And like, I don't even like anybody else in the movie theater, not to mention somebody next to me.
The worst is people talking.
Well, the worst to me, I mean, I hate talking, that's way out of line, but there's something about putting your feet on the chair in front of you. You only do that if that chair is empty.
Right.
If somebody's sitting in that chair in front of you, you can't put your feet on it. It's like the same thing with an airplane.
There's if you do, you're an asshole. There's some people that do put their feet on other people's chairs.
Yeah.
And it's super rude.
Well, you can feel that in a movie theater. Yeah. They give you that 2-inch push that, you know, to where you could sort of like lean back. But so you feel it every time, like big time. So then you're watching a movie and shit's serious. And all of a sudden now you're thinking about what kind of shoes the person behind you is wearing. Or like if they're even wearing shoes or this and that, and how out of line that is to do that at a movie theater. Like, it's so out of line. And by the way, popcorn. How did that become the thing at the movie theater? I know it sounds like a hacky, like, premise, but how did that become the theater food?
Because it's delicious and it's a good snack.
It's a good snack. I don't know if I'd give it delicious.
With butter and salt?
Yeah, I mean, the first few bites, they get you with that. Dude, popcorn's only good for about 10 bites, and then it's just a workout. And it's the and it's the loudest thing out of everything.
It's like not the loud, but it is loud. Yeah, it's crunch, crunch,
so
crunch.
So loud.
And it's not as loud as chips.
And every time somebody opens the door, you can hear it popping in the lobby, too. Like, it's, like, loud to make. It's loud to eat. You can hear it when people drop it.
When was the last time you heard it pop in the lobby? Where are you going to the movies?
The New Beverly Cinema on Beverly and La Brea. Quentin Tarantino's theater. They show, like, old really? Westerns.
Oh, do you go there?
Dude, I watched The Good, the Bad, the Ugly a few weeks ago.
Really?
With the crowd going crazy. Crazy, man. Dude.
When I need to go.
Laughing at the funny scenes, gasping at the serious ones. Like, they show real old movies. October, they just had Halloween. They showed, like, Beetlejuice, Night of the Living Dead, like, cool movies.
Chips would be worse, though, wouldn't they?
Yeah.
That would be the worst.
Yeah. Yeah. And the bag of chips. You're right. Chips would be terrible.
This shitty fucking church
yeah.
keeps letting us think. It's like a dog next door. Like, there's a guy named Frank Santarelli, who's a funny comic from Boston. He was in The Sopranos. He had a scene that's probably was a bartender in Sopranos. And he had this bit about a dog barking next door right when you think it's going to stop. Like, bark, 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 bark. Like, right when you would think it would stop. Bark, 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 bark. Like, in that, that's like this fucking stupid church.
Yeah.
Some asshole is next door just clanging on those bells.
Yeah. Some hunchback.
Some freak. Did you hear about what's going on with Quentin Tarantino, where the cops are boycotting him?
Yeah.
They don't want to work his movies because he called them killers?
Yeah.
Kind of interesting.
Yeah. Well, I'm pretty sure, I'm pretty sure that, you know, first of all, they're drawing more attention to it than would have been had they not boycotted his movies. They wouldn't be talking about Quentin Tarantino doing that. The only thing that they're talking about is New York police boycott Quentin Tarantino's movies.
I think it's L.A. police.
Coming out at the end of December, by the way. You know what I mean? Like, it's a promo. These things backfire when these people try to do this stuff.
But it also makes people aware that what he's saying is irresponsible. You know, to call all cops killers. When you think about how many cops and how many interactions the cops have all day long. I mean, yeah, it is terrible when, like, something like Sandra Bland or all these different scenarios take place where people do wind up dying at the hand of cops. It's absolutely horrific. But how many, you look at the actual numbers of how many cops there are and how many interactions these cops have with human beings and how many different interactions happen during a day and how many times it leads to a real problem. Those problems, for sure, are horrific and they're real issues. But overall, I mean, to label all cops killers or all cops murderers or all cops like that, it is... in a way, irresponsible, and it's easy to do.
Did he say all cops?
I don't know what his words were.
I don't even think he did. I think he said something to the effect of cops have been murdering innocent people, you know, something like that. And, you know, for them to run with it, I mean, okay, guys, so what an imprint you're going to leave on this brand new, you know, Hateful Eight movie that's going to be the shit.
What, like, is the movie supposed to be about?
Oh, God.
What is it?
Gee, it's going to be so good. It's about, basically, the gist is sort of like Civil War. It's sort of like Django meets Inglourious Basterds.
Oh.
Like, it's like Civil War, but, like, really badass. Kurt Russell.
Civil War, huh?
Yeah. Civil War mixed with, like, assassins, and they kidnap someone.
In the late 1800s? That's when it's supposed to be taking place? Yeah.
Dude, Kurt Russell has this huge beard and this huge mustache. Like,
so was he growing it for the movie or is it fake?
Oh, it's real. He fucking did it.
Wonder how long it took him to grow something like that.
A long time. They all do that shit. They make them fucking work. You know, Quentin, you've seen Kill Bill.
Yeah.
He sent them all to Japan to train in the art of the samurai sword. That entire assassination squad. The Deadly Vipers. David Carradine, Vivica A. Fox, Michael Madsen, Uma Thurman, and Daryl Hannah. They all went to fucking Japan. and stayed in cool little Japanese fucking, you know, condos with like sliding everything was like super culture.
Wow.
For them to really get in the zone. So you can tell that they know what they're doing when they're doing their crazy shit. Like, you can feel it in that movie, I feel like, at least. But anyway, yeah, I mean, like, you know, those cops are gonna see that movie. They can say they're gonna boycott it. What are they? I mean, I would say they'd put on a fake mustache, but they probably already have mustaches. They're gonna shave their mustaches to go sneak in. Like, oh, I'm not going to see this movie. My ass. You're gonna miss Kurt Russell with an all-out beard and a Civil War assassin saga? Okay, officer. Your loss. You might as well just go kill innocent people. You're gonna
miss that movie.
I don't know what's worse, missing that movie or killing innocent people. But I'm just a huge Tarantino nerd fan, so. But I think everybody should be.
He's definitely made some fucking awesome movies. Pulp Fiction was such a game changer. You were watching on the way up here.
Mm-hmm.
I looked over and I saw that image of the girl and the guy at the diner at the beginning of the movie, mm-hmm. where they're talking to each other right when they kiss before they rob the place.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, wow, that's like the beginning of the stitch that ties that whole crazy movie together.
Yeah, it's unbelievable.
Yeah.
Different time frames of all that. You know what I mean? Like, when they come back to that at the end,
mm-hmm.
and they're robbing the place, and Travolta and Samuel L. are sitting there, by the time that happens at the end, we know Travolta gets killed by Bruce Willis,
mm-hmm.
10, 15, 20 minutes before that. That Samuel L. ends up retiring from the game because of the bullet holes in the wall. Which, it's like all just like crazy.
I haven't seen that movie in a long time. I need to go watch it again.
Fun fact is, I was watching it without the sound on. I was listening to music and just had my headphones off. Because I know every single inch of that movie so well that I don't even need to have the sound. Like, it's fun to have the sound, but it's also fun to, like, see their lips moving and knowing exactly what's going on.
Yeah. Yeah, I was doing the same thing with The Lord of the Rings.
Did you end up watching that new Mission Impossible?
No.
Oh, God, it was really good. I was really surprised. I'm not a Mission Impossible guy at all, but this new one's great.
Those movies are so stupid.
I know, but this one was, like, so good it was, like, funny. There was
really?
A few times where I laughed out loud. Like, I was like, this is fucking impressive. Like, I think all those are crap. All of them. But this one was, like, really well written.
Those movies, it's hard to get me to sign up for, like, a Bond movie, mm-hmm. or, like, a Mission Impossible movie. Because, like, you know that Tom Cruise is going to be okay. You know Daniel Craig's going to make it to the end of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever bad guys he's facing, he's going to wind up killing. Mm-hmm. Oh, he's almost going to die, but he doesn't. Psych!
Right.
Like, you know, no matter what, but...
Yeah, there's always one of those scenes where they're dead, and then, like, all of a sudden somebody has the paddles, and they jolt them back to life.
Like, what did I see recently that was like that, that I had a really hard time getting into? Because I knew that... Oh, The Martian. I knew he was going to live.
Yeah.
Like, oh my God, he's almost dying.
Right.
But he's not.
Yeah.
There was no drama. Like, when they were talking about coming back to get him, I'm like, they're going to get him.
Right.
They're going to get him. He's going to live. Like, oh my God, he's floating in space. He's got to figure out how to get to them so they can grab him and bring him on board. They're going to figure it out. Like, there was no drama.
Right.
It was so... It's so problematic when you have, like, a star. And one individual star that is responsible for driving the whole movie. And the whole movie was based on Matt Damon getting off Mars. He got trapped on Mars, and they had to go back and get him. So because of the fact that it was based on that, like, you knew he was going to make it.
Mm-hmm.
You knew. There was no real suspense. And well, at the end of the movie was kind of anticlimactic.
Yeah.
Because you knew it. Whereas... Even a movie like Alien, like the original Alien with Sigourney Weaver, you kind of knew that Sigourney Weaver was going to make it, but the way they did it was so clever, and they fucking killed off everybody but her, that it was okay. It was okay because it was so chaotic.
I've been on a movie rampage lately, and I purposefully didn't go see The Martian.
Really?
Yeah, I'm like allergic to Matt Damon.
Why are you allergic to Matt Damon?
Oh, there's just something about him. I just think he's, like, the most overworked, overrated, like, just bland, boring. I think Rounders would have been better without him. I think Malkovich buried him in that movie. He couldn't follow anything Malkovich was doing with his Oreos and all that stuff. I think Ben Affleck's the same thing. And I think they're like this duo of dog shit that just...
Duo of dog shit.
That just, like, is, somehow they got this, like, Good Will Hunting momentum. And, like, everybody's just like, yeah, they're cool because they're from Good Will Hunting. It's like, no, I'm not buying it. Ben Affleck's a tool. He's not cool at all. Matt Damon is, like, you know...
If you want to know how much of a tool Ben Affleck really is, you have to watch him on Real Time with Bill Maher. Ooh. Watch him on Real Time with Bill Maher, where he accuses Sam Harris. You know, I don't know if you know who Sam Harris is, a brilliant intellectual who's written many, many books on religion. He's just a fucking super genius. And he accused him of being racist for his stance on Islam, like radical Islam and fundamentalist Islam, being like a really dangerous proposition, a dangerous ideology. And he did it in such a stupid, clunky, like, ignorant way, and looked so dumb and so much forced outrage while he was doing it. Like, you watch him do it, you go, oh, my God, fuck this guy. I see what he's doing. He was totally going, like, social justice, brownie points,
right,
like, trying to stand up for the oppressed. And the way he did it was so awkward and loud and shouty. It was so dumb. It was so dumb that it instantly reveals how weak his actual argument was. He was trying to back it up by calling him a racist. Mm-hmm. He was trying to, like, put him on the back of his heels. Like, but you can't do that to Harris because he's a master debater. Like, he debates with people all the time, religious people all the time. So when you do that, he, like, never loses his cool, which made Ben Affleck look even dumber. And then Bill Maher is taking Sam Harris aside as well, and they're both going, like, I think you're missing what he's saying. And he's like, it's racist. Oh, my God, it's racist. Like, what you're saying is so racist. But it's so dumb and clunky, and it's just you realize, like, the poor quality of his thinking and how high he holds his own opinions. Yeah. Like, what, you know, it's, you have to see it, but it's so toolish. I can't say I'll never respect his opinion again, but I value it so much less after watching that argument.
We should boycott his movies.
He was good in Gone Girl, though. Did you see Gone Girl?
He was good in Gone Girl, but you know what? I think that was just an extremely well-written, well-directed movie that easily could have slipped. You could have slipped a Kevin Spacey in there, and it's like
20%
better. Well, yeah, you know, but some, I know.
He's
but
too,
like,
gay and fat, too. You'd have to have someone younger and handsome. But yeah, you could have...
Yeah, I mean, like, anybody.
Jake Gyllenhaal probably would have crushed it.
Totally. Yeah. Much better performance. Much better. Because there's something about Ben Affleck...
He's milk.
...where you watch him and it makes you... You just know it's Ben Affleck.
Yeah.
You know, it's like he doesn't really break out of the... He's never like a different... You're never like, I didn't even notice that was Ben Affleck. You know what I mean? Like how that's that way with so many great actors. And, like, you're like, oh, I didn't even notice that was him. Like, he's so good in it.
Yeah, I felt like that in that, what was that movie that he did? The Town. That was another movie. It's like, God, anybody could have done that. The Town movie where he plays the bank robber guy. Remember that movie?
No.
Mm-mm. Him and his buddies, they're all bank robbers from Charlestown. Charlestown was, like, a real area of Boston that was filled with, like, legit criminals. And they were, like, a legit high amount of bank robbers. It came out as one area.
Hmm.
But he's done a bunch of those Boston movies, too.
Yeah.
You know, that's where Good Will Hunting was.
I love what South Park does with Matt Damon. Like, they just...
retarded.
Yeah.
But he's not stupid, so it's so funny. When they do those, like, when they did Team America World Police, and he's like, Matt Damon.
Yeah.
Like, made him so stupid, but he's not stupid.
Oh, I love it. I think those guys are crap. Just crappity crap.
Yeah, and they're an interesting duo.
Yeah. I don't know.
It's hard to be an actor and not be a douchebag and full of shit. Mm-hmm. Just to make it through the ranks.
Yeah.
To get to a position where you're an actual movie star and all the dicks you've sucked along the way. Mm-hmm. Figuratively. Not literally, necessarily.
Like Christian Bale, you know, like he yelled at those people and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But you know what? Sorry. He's fucking good. He's fucking good.
Well, not only that, the guy's distracting him in the background while he's in this really important emotional scene, and you want to shame him by recording that as if he's an asshole, but guess what? The guy who's distracting him and fucking with the lights, that guy's an idiot.
Yeah.
And you can have idiots like that on the set, and they do ruin things. They do. And if he's a perfectionist, like, obviously he is.
Yeah.
He couldn't possibly be as good as he is without being a perfectionist. when you have someone who's like irritating you like that, that's on the set, yeah, I could see him snapping. It makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's like, you know, people are like, ooh, Christian Bale's a dick. It's like,
to that guy, but we don't even know who that guy was.
Right.
Maybe if we met that guy, we'd be like, oh, you're a fucking moron.
Yeah, or else maybe we'd be hearing more of these clips of Christian Bale yelling at innocent people. Instead, there was just that one.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, my patience grows a lot longer for people who I respect. You know, I have a whole bit about it, you know, about Bill Cosby and Woody Allen, about this thing. You can get away with stuff if you're talented. You make multiple hits and you're good. You can get away with shit.
Well, there's obviously a point of no return for a guy like Cosby. He can't get away with it anymore. He stopped performing. Remember, in the beginning, he was performing.
Yeah.
He had all these dates that he was doing while the accusations were coming out. People were still like yelling out, we love you, Bill. We love you, Bill. But now, even those people are like, damn, Bill's a racist.
Totally.
Racist. He's a rapist, rather.
Yeah. I think he's going to Paterno out. You know what I mean? Like how Joe Paterno. Yeah, something like that. Joe Paterno, like, the week that he retired, it was so crazy. Like, yeah, I just watched a 30 for 30 ESPN documentary on it. You ever watch those?
Yeah.
And it said, they were talking about how literally the day that he announced his retirement, he went home and took a bloody poop. Next day goes to the doctor, is like, my poop's bloody. And they're like, yeah, your body's filled with cancer right now. He's like, oh, okay. Like, 7 days later, he was dead. Something like that.
Wow.
It was, like, so fast.
Well, he probably had the stress of knowing that he was harboring a child molester for years. It was probably eating away at him. Besides the fact that he was an old guy, as it is. But you think about what kind of stress must be involved in having a guy like that that you know is fucking kids and you don't know what to do about it. You don't know what to do because he's got this whole charitable organization where he's taking care of children, and you know, and everybody else knows he's fucking those kids. And then when it comes out, the world knows that you knew he was fucking those kids and you didn't do anything about it, and you should have, and you were a coward, and it just starts rotting you out from the inside.
Oh
my God, it must be fucking devastating.
I mean, it's like it's like almost like just being as bad as the pedophile. Except you don't even get to, like, blow those loads, you know what I mean?
I would love to, if Bill, that's so rude. if it turns out that Bill Cosby has cancer and he's dying and he wants to come clean and he wants to talk about it all, I would love to have him on a podcast. Yeah. Can you imagine having Bill Cosby on a podcast before he's dying? Just asking him, like, how did this all start? Like, what was it all about? Like, when did you first drug somebody? Did you get, is it something that excited you? Was it a convenience thing? Like, what was it that made you think that it's okay? Because he has daughters, right? I believe he has daughters. So. God, man, I can imagine.
I don't even know how anybody could get into something like that. Like, it's so interesting. That's such a weird, like, fetish. Because he clearly could have just had sex with whoever he wanted.
Well, he clearly could have just had prostitutes.
Definitely.
He's worth so much money.
Yeah.
He could have always done that. Or he could have always, like, found someone who wanted to have sex with him. But I think he liked drugging them. It's the only thing that makes sense to me.
Mm-hmm. I think there's something which makes you wonder. I don't even know. I've never heard of it before. But it's like, you know, what is that? What is that? If that's a fetish, then why couldn't you just pay a prostitute almost to do that?
Yeah, but then it wouldn't really be happening. See, I think part of it had to be that he wanted to trick those girls. He wanted to give them, hey, come over here and have a cappuccino. Right. He gives them a cappuccino and they're like, oh, you feeling sleepy, are you? And he just pulls his cock out. You don't even see this, do you? And then they, you know, he throws them on the bed and pulls their panties off and fucks them while they're out cold. Like, he must have been into that. He must have been into the game of drugging them.
Mm-hmm.
He must have been into, like, slipping them a Mickey and watching them black out.
Yeah.
But then he's, like, stuck with them for hours while they try to sober up, too. Mm-hmm. How bizarre is that? Like, he had to be with them while they were out cold when he drugged them. And he had to be willing to deal with that.
There's other ways he could have gone about it, too. Like, you know, like, he could have just, like, you know. I'm interested to know if he ever just had him come over and sat down and watched like a Ben Affleck movie with him just to make him fall asleep instead of drugging him, you know, just like, oh, you allergic to the Matt Damon?
I don't think that, I think that a guy like that, a guy like Cosby, is probably a sociopath.
Yeah.
In some sort of a strange way, a very unique way. Mm-hmm. An egomaniac, a sociopath, and feels like he's better than people. It feels like it's okay. It's okay if he drugs them.
Remember, somebody, I don't know if we can talk about this, but what that person told us in that green room that one time about him?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
We could probably mention that.
Yeah, we
right?
could talk about that. We've talked about it. I've talked about it before.
Oh, okay.
She said that he was at a casino, and he made the security guard tuck him in. Come to his hotel room and tuck him in. And this is all before the allegations came out, but not much before, like a few months before, like 6 months at the most. And we were there like right when all this was breaking. It was over a year ago.
See, that should have been a sign right there. Anybody who needs to get tucked in should get like investigated by the FBI, right?
Well, it's like, why did he want to get tucked in? Like, right. What's going on with that? He also wanted people to watch him eat. Do you remember that, too? He would have them sit down, the whole staff, like all the people that worked there, they would sit in his dressing room and watch him eat curry. He would eat his food, and they would sit around. They didn't interact with him. They would just sit around and watch him eat.
Wow.
Like, what?
That's some freaky stuff.
But what a weird request.
Yeah.
But I think he probably had a bunch of those weird things mm-hmm. that he had in his mind. That, like we were at this club last night, and someone, we don't have to mention their name, mm-hmm. but some comedian that we know.
Yeah.
And they were all saying what a piece of shit the guy was. They would never have him back here again. But that when they got to the airport, he's like, you know, telling him to carry his luggage. And then when people were there, he's like, don't let anybody touch me. When people come over to take my picture, don't let anybody touch me. And then it's just like the weirdness of how he interacted with these people that worked there. They're like, look, you'll never be back here again.
Right.
Like, we just let you know right now. You're never coming back here again.
Yeah.
And they said he was like the worst guy they had ever had come to their club. But this guy who we're talking about had all these weird tics and all these mm-hmm. weird things that he would do, like make people carry his stuff, like mm-hmm. things that he would do to clearly establish that he was better than them.
Right. Make them sell his merch.
Yeah.
Things like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
And that neurosis that these people have, it's so ridiculous because most of the most talented people that I've met drive their own car, carry their own bag, all of it, and would be insulted if somebody tried that kind of stuff. You know what I mean? Like, come on, give me my bag. You know, like, yeah. It's like the opposite, because that's simply not how success works. There's no, you don't get extra time to think because somebody else is carrying your bag. Then you have more pride in the person that you're hanging out with because they're carrying their bag and you're carrying your bag, you know? It just seems like the neurosis of it all is like such an old Hollywood myth.
Well, it's one thing is like maybe you had two big bags and like a driver came. Let me help you with that. They grab one of your roller bags and ask you some questions and pull it around with you. But his thing was like making everyone do the work. Like, he didn't want to carry anything.
Right.
He wanted them to pick up his bags at the airport. But I think when people demand preferential or special treatment like that, They start to think of themselves as being superior to everyone else. Everyone else, you know, throw your rose petals on the ground so that I may walk upon them. You know, this idea that Cosby was better than all those people that he was drugging. Mm-hmm. He was better than all those people that were watching him eat curry. That he was better than that guy who he wanted to tuck him in. Tuck me in. I'm the king.
Right.
I will lie in my bed. And when I lie in my bed, then I want you to put the blanket over me. And then I want you to tuck it on each side, and I will rest.
Oh.
And then you will leave, shut the light out, the king is sleeping.
Yeah.
There's something creepy about that.
Yeah.
That's also the same kind of thing, in some sort of a way, that would allow him to have done all that horrific shit that he did, drugging those people.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody's really going to understand it unless he talks about it.
Yeah.
Unless he comes clean and talks about it, we're never going to understand his unique psychosis.
I'd love to know that. What would be the first question? Like, what would
when
be
did a, you do it? Yeah. When did you first do it? Who was the? Did you see someone drug someone? Was that a common thing? I think people like slipping someone a Mickey. They didn't think of it as that big of a deal back then.
Right.
I think it was more. I don't think they thought of it as rape. I think they thought they were being sneaky. But I think it was like you know, getting her a couple of drinks. Have a couple of drinks. Relax. Okay. You know, voluntarily, a girl has a couple of drinks. And you know, once they have a couple of drinks, they're going to loosen up. They're going to be a little more playful, a little more uninhibited. Woo! Next thing you know, old Jed's a millionaire.
Yep.
I wonder what it was that started him down that path of drugging and raping women. This lady was on TV and she was talking about it. She's like, he might be the most prolific serial rapist in history.
Mm-hmm.
You stop and think about it like, that's fucking insane. Bill Cosby mm-hmm. might be the most prolific rapist in history.
He really could be. 45 women, at least.
At least.
Have accused him. And those are the ones that have accused him. The yeah. ones on the road, like, and he's been touring forever. Everywhere. He's just been going everywhere. Chicks from Tennessee and the Oklahoma, they're not gonna admit that stuff. They don't even know what's going on. They're not even watching the news. They don't even know other women are coming out with it. You know? And people with families. Think of how many of those ladies must have families now and they're not coming forward.
Well, also, they probably don't think, what is the point in
right.
adding their own story to a 50-person mm-hmm. story?
Mm-hmm.
You're already dealing with a guy who's accused of multiple horrific crimes. Like, if you accuse him of one more, is it going to change anything?
Right.
There's one girl, though, that it's within the statute of limitations.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. There's one girl that they're pursuing that is inside the statute of limitations. And if that comes through, if they wind up, like, he might actually wind up going to jail.
Mm.
Or at least standing trial, or, I mean, I don't know. I don't know how it works. Like, I guess she has to press charges, and maybe he could bribe her. Maybe he could settle. You know, like, that term settling out of court, that's just bribing someone.
Totally.
That's what he did in 2005.
Yeah.
The reason why we know about what he did was because of the deposition that they released once all these other accusations started piling up. Then they released the results of the deposition. So we got to know that, oh, he admitted that he gave girls Quaaludes. You know?
Mm-hmm.
Or that he had, I mean, you can't even get Quaaludes anymore. Like, this guy had some Quaaludes stockpiled.
Yeah. I mean, they have probable cause.
Like, what is happening with that case? That's what's crazy. You don't hear about it. For months and months and months, there's no updates.
Even the case has been put to sleep. That's hell.
Son of a bitch. And on that note,
I was going to make a probable Cosby joke and didn't ago. Just to let you know, like, the ones that I don't say, like, those exist too. I don't just say
probable
ever.
Cosby. Oh, no. Oh, no.
Win in Rome.
It's like one of those things that we could talk about a million times in a row.
Yeah.
And we always just bang our head against the wall. There's like, it's almost like you're repeating the same conversation over and over again. Like, how could we do it? What was it about? The Michael Jackson thing is really similar.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you repeat the Michael Jackson thing many, many times, but he's dead. So it makes it kind of weirder.
Yeah.
Because you'll never know. You'll never know if he really did those things or if, you know, he just got weird with those kids. I'd heard a weird possibility about Michael Jackson that I've talked about before, but that he was a castrata.
What's that?
That means he had his balls removed. You ever heard castrata singing? Uh-uh. You never heard of that?
No.
Oh, my God. They would have this, they would have young men, when they were really young, they would castrate them. And they would castrate them with a specific purpose of making their voice sound a certain way. You never heard of that?
If it ever happened, I bet it happened to him.
They were a type of opera singer. They would do it on purpose.
Wow.
Yeah. How crazy is that?
That's
they would
so
castrate
cool.
young boys so that their sound would, they would keep a certain sound. Mm. You want to hear some of it? Hold on a second. I'm going to grab my laptop. Hang in there, folks.
Someone.
I'm walking across
the hotel room to grab my laptop.
So Michael Jackson may not have had any balls?
Well, you think about his voice, like the sounds that he was able to make with his voice.
Yeah, I believe it. His dad probably did it. That he's the one that wanted the money, right?
Could you imagine if that's what he did? Yeah. Like he had a sound when he was young, mm-hmm. and so they castrated him so that he kept that same sound.
Na 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 na.
Yeah. Let me pull this castrata music. Castrato.
Wow.
Yeah, castrat.
That's insane.
Music. Yeah. Well, it's just how insane is it that is an actual style of music? Listen to this.
The testosterone clearly would affect the voice box. I mean, that's...
Yeah.
Jeez, I didn't know that existed.
Listen to this. Yeah. This is a 1994 biopic, so that might not be legit, but it's about one of the most famous castrato singers. Like, here's need to know facts, 20 need to know facts about castratis. Okay, the Vatican imported its very first falsetto singers from Spain. It was considered preferable to have castrated boys singing high parts, since girls and women were banned in the Vatican choir. The 17th century was a bad time to be a good treble. During the 17th century, boys in Italy began to be castrated in increasing numbers. This took place between the ages of 7 and 11 to preserve the purity of their unbroken voices so they could sing in church choirs.
Mm.
Castration operations were performed by actual butchers. The operations to remove a boy's testicles, in medical terms, was called orchidectomy, were reputedly performed by the butchers of Norcia, an Italian region famous for its pork products, where castration of pigs was common, because they castrate pigs. They oftentimes will castrate pigs like in the wild, and they let them go, and then they try to hunt those pigs because they can't breed, but they eat a lot, and so they get really fat, and they don't have as much muscle. It's a density of muscle which comes from testosterone, so they become fat and thick, and like this softer meat. Only a tiny fraction of the children mutilated in this way even made it onto the stage. By the early 1700s, as many as 4,000 Italian boys a year underwent the operation, which was illegal. Of those who survived, only a fraction went on to train as opera singers, and of those, only a handful became superstars. Being a castrato could have unexpected physical consequences. The most famous castratis were trained in Neapolitan conservatories, where they practiced breathing techniques for hours every day to expand their lung capacities. As a result, adult castrati were often notably barrel-chested. They were tall compared to normal men of their time, but they also had a shortened life expectancy. Like, look at the images of them. These images where they show this barrel-chested, tall guy. Like, how odd. Like, that, like, is like he's got a little head and little hands with a long, tall torso.
Wow.
Yeah. This is incredible, man. Really, so this article is Sinfini Music, S-I-N-F-I-N-I music.com. And it's all 20 facts, 20 known facts about castratis. Mm. And some of them actually got married, these poor bastards. You know, it's horrific, man. And there was an actual BBC documentary. But here's an actual castrati. The only recording of an actual castrato is a guy. His name is Alessandro Morisecchi, and he died in 1922. So this is an actual castrati we're going to listen to here. This is a real one. The other one that we played earlier was apparently a sort of a recreation. This is a real castrati here.
Oh,
That's some haunting shit.
That's as scary as it gets.
That's a guy with no balls.
This shit's nuts.
Now stop and listen to this and stop and think about Michael Jackson. Think about how feminine he was and how thin he was. Just how fucked up are people that they would even think to do this to a 7-year-old boy? How fucked up were the parents that let this be done? Their 7-year-old boy, let him get his nuts chopped off so he can make better noise with his face.
That's crazy. Oh, it's scary. For some reason, that's like the scariest thing that I've seen in a long time.
It's crazy.
To lose your balls without a choice and to have it done by a butcher. I mean, my God. I mean, that, think of all the things that ruins. From now on, you smell bacon and things like that. Like, it reminds you of getting your balls chopped off.
No, it doesn't. Bacon?
I mean, maybe you have to go into a butcher shop to do it. Yeah, it's a traumatic experience, I'm sure.
The traumatic part is listening to this tortured soul.
Oh, I know.
This fucking grown man who... Oh, my God. It's just, it's insane.
That's freaky.
It's very freaky. It's just... It's hard to believe that people looked at human life like that.
I feel like this church next door keeps playing their bells every time we talk about crazy mm-hmm. shit that the Catholic Church used to do.
I wonder what's worse. Is it the church sound, the bells worse, or this?
That's worse.
Is it?
That's like a tortured soul. I was just going to say, like, you can really, like, feel some kind of pain. A pain that he didn't even, like, pick. It wasn't, like, his fault. Like, he was thrown to the wolves.
I wonder if when they did the autopsy, if they found balls. What if they didn't find balls? Would they tell us? They did the Michael Jackson autopsy?
They wouldn't tell us shit.
Yeah, that's, like, medical information, right?
Yeah. They wouldn't tell us.
Imagine if he went to his grave like that and everybody kept their mouth shut. Meanwhile, he was castrated when he was younger to make his voice sound better. I guarantee you Joe Jackson knew about this. Mm-hmm. I guarantee you. This is not, I mean, if I know about this, people know about this, people in the music business that actually are singers and that are a part of, you know, the industry, they definitely know about castrados. Mm-hmm. Ooh, I wonder, man. That's just my own personal theory, by the way.
Yeah, I mean, and Michael Jackson could definitely hit some notes.
Yeah.
I mean...
Like, what's a song? Think of a song where Michael Jackson, like, really nailed high notes.
Well, I mean, when he was in the Jackson 5, he
was... How about Human Nature, right?
Yeah.
Well, wouldn't it...
But I guess he was still a kid when he was in the Jackson 5.
Right. But listen, this is Human Nature. This is a song from... this is a song from when he was... how old do you think he was when he did that? He was a grown man, for sure. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So this is waiting for this ad to run out. He was probably in his 30s when he came up with this, right? Whoa.
He doesn't sound like a man.
No. How fucked? How fucked is that?
I think he may have been missing some of his human nature.
You fucking son of a bitch.
Tough to look at the man in the mirror when you lose your ball.
Ow, you fucking can't stop, can you? You can't stop. I know, but that's the sound.
You ever see when he caught his head on fire in the Pepsi commercial?
Yeah, scream. Listen to this. I can't listen anymore.
Yeah.
This is obviously just my theory.
Well,
I might have heard it somewhere too. I might have heard other people. I've been thinking about this for so long. I don't know. But when you listen to the castrato and then you hear that, mm-hmm. boy.
I mean, he clearly wasn't hooking up with anybody. I'm sorry, but the Presley girl, like, that was clearly a media blitz. Like, King of Pop marries the king of...
Did he even marry her?
Yeah, we...
Did he marry her?
I think so. Lisa Marie?
Did he marry her?
I think so.
He kissed her, but did he marry her?
I thought he married her. I thought they had, like, a fake kid or something together.
No, they didn't have a fake kid, but he definitely had fake kids with somebody else, where it turns out that it wasn't even his sperm.
Right. Well, it couldn't have been his sperm, because his balls are in Joe Jackson's freezer right now.
Okay, Lisa Marie Presley. Let's see. Do they marriage? The personal relationships of Michael Jackson. Let's see. The entertainer was said his first real date was with the child actress Tatum O'Neill when he was a teenager in the 1970s. He called her my first love after Diana Ross. The pair eventually cooled off, in quotes, and Jackson entered into a romance with model Brooke Shields in 1981. Okay, what? Although the relationship became largely platonic, Shields said there were times where he asked her to marry him. As they grew older, the two saw each other less. Whoa. Lisa Marie Presley by her father Elvis in 1974, blah, blah, blah. Shortly after becoming involved with her, in 1993, Jackson was subjected to his first set of child sexual abuse accusations. I didn't know that. Followed by similar allegations in 2003. Presley supported Jackson as became dependent on pain medication and eventually helped convince him to enter drug rehabilitation. In a telephone call, he proposed marriage to Presley. She agreed, and the two wed.
Boom.
May 26, 1994, at a private ceremony in the Dominican Republic.
Clearly had to marry her because he was under child abuse things.
Yeah. What the fuck?
Mm-hmm.
What the fuck?
Mm-hmm.
Ooh.
He doesn't have balls.
Didn't she, like, eventually go on, Lisa Marie, to marry, like,
somebody weird.
Wasn't it the actor? What the fuck's his name?
Billy Bob Thornton.
No. Nicolas Cage. Didn't she marry Nicolas Cage?
I don't know.
I'm pretty sure she did. Let's go to Lisa Marie Presley. Wikipedia is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Relationships. Let's go to relationships here. Relationships. Marriages and relationships. Bam. She married one guy in 1988. Michael Jackson. Michael Jackson spent 4 years following their divorce together on and off to attempt to reconcile. Blah, 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 blah. Nicolas Cage. Presley's third marriage was to Nicolas Cage. They were married August 10th, 2002, in an Oceanside ceremony on the Big Island of Hawaii. Yeah, whatever. What the fuck?
She hooked up with some weirdos.
Well, imagine being Elvis's daughter. What a weird life that must have been. You've been married to the most famous guy the world had ever known. Mm-hmm. At the time, the most famous entertainer that had ever existed by far. Like, there was never a guy like Elvis before Elvis. Because when Elvis came along, he was like at the moment when movies and radio and television, all that collided. And someone could see a guy like that on TV, on the Ed Sullivan Show, you know, swinging his hips and, mm-hmm. you know, jailhouse rock. And women just wah!
Yeah.
Imagine as your fucking dad. Yeah. Imagine trying to be normal. That guy didn't have a chance at being normal. There was not like today, if you're Drake or if you're Jay-Z or if you're fucking, you know, John Mayer, there's a lot of those dudes out there. There's a lot of them that girls will go crazy and scream for. They can hang out together and go to parties and go, man, life's crazy, right? Yeah, bro, life's crazy for us. Yeah. But Elvis had Elvis. That was it. Who else is there? Fabian?
Right.
Fabian had like one song.
I don't even know who Fabian is.
He was like a heartthrob for a very short amount of time in the 50s. Hmm. There was like a couple other guys. But Elvis was uniquely famous in a way that, like, until Michael Jackson came along, there's probably nobody like him or close to it or very few people like him. Imagine that. Poor Lisa Marie is his daughter.
I can't really take Elvis seriously as an actor. Have you ever seen any of his movies?
Oh, they're dog shit.
You don't take him serious as an actor, though. He's not an actor. He's
a singer. That's how I feel about Matt Damon and Ben Affleck. Those fuckers can't even sing.
Maybe they should be singing.
Maybe.
Maybe they missed their calling.
Yeah. Let's cut off their nuts and see if it's too late. I wouldn't mind seeing if it works.
And on that note, we're gonna hit the gym and work out. What time is it here? It is 3:50 here in wonderful Melbourne, Australia. Which, by the way, Melbourne is the fucking shit. How great is this town?
Amazing.
God damn, it's fun. Last night was incredible.
Yeah.
All right, that was 2 hours. So that's it. This is the end of our podcast from Melbourne. You can catch Tony Hinchcliffe on Twitter. It's Tony at Tony Hinchcliffe. Kill Tony is his podcast. One Shot. Can you announce anything?
No, you can't announce anything. But you know,
coming soon to a major internet distribution network that you all know of.
Yes,
that we can't say the name of.
And when I get to announce it, I'm hopefully come back on again and talk with Joe again about more fun stuff.
Yes, indeed. Yes. All right, we got two shows tonight. Two sold out shows at some giant theater. Was it the Palais Theater?
P-A-L-A-I-S.
I think it's Palais.
Palais. Yeah.
Palais Theater tonight in Melbourne. Mm-hmm. And we're fucking psyched. Yeah. And all right, that's it, folks. That's the end. Anything more to say, Tony?
I'd like to just say, even though this isn't out yet, good luck to Johanna Jędrzejczyk tomorrow. I'm a huge fan, and I love your striking. And, you know, if we accidentally end up on a date sometime, whoopsie. But I think you really like my sense of humor. And I am a little bit bigger than you. So, like, I know pictures of me. I look really small, but I'm like 140 pounds. So, thank you, and good luck.